Stick to Wrestling Every Day. My name is John McAdam. Thank you for listening to the Stick to Wrestling podcast. Give us 60 minutes and we will give you a wicked good wrestling podcast. Quick thing I wanted to say, thank everyone for listening. I mean, I hope this world sucks sometimes. It sucks really bad sometimes. And if I can give you guys a 60-minute distraction from all that, I'm doing something good. So thank you for listening. If you would like to PayPal Sean and I, the address is prowrestlingarchives@gmail.com. Once again, no amount is too small, and I'm grateful for those who have already chipped in. So with that said, I would like to bring in my convivial co-host, Mr. Sean Goodwin. Sean, how are you?
I am. We are 2 days away from the birth of the country. You know, 17 said we are, you know, 2 days away from when we're taping. It'll be afterwards, you know, when you're hearing it. But right now it's 2 days before. And when you think of America and you think of that patriotic spirit, what do you think of?
Memphis Wrestling. Wrestling.
Well, that too. But I certainly think Memphis Wrestling. And we got so many questions on our amazing Facebook page, which the numbers are going up every day. The members on there, and never an argument, always good natured. And we had so many questions last week that they have come up. We're going to answer more this week. We actually only got through three last week, so we still have plenty to go.
We only got through three. I didn't even realize that. Wow. Yeah, the Facebook page, just look up Stick to Wrestling and sign up. I mean, you have to ask to join, but I always say yes. And yeah, it is a fantastic companion piece. And with that said, I want to bring on my special guest this week, Howard Baum. Howard, thank you for coming on. How are you, man?
Tremendous. Tremendous. It's Bound, by the way, but that's
Bound,
all right.
Sorry. All
that's
these
right.
years.
That's the official pronunciation. No such thing as Baum.
Okay.
But people can't refrain, so I kind of go with it, but I try to correct wherever I can. But whoop, whoop. Very happy to be here. And debut my new catchphrase.
All right. What's your new catchphrase?
Whoop, whoop.
That's a good one. Now, I'm glad we could segue into this because we're doing a little bit of a Memphis show. And, Howard, I've got a question for you. I talked to Sean about this. He does not know that you were the person who presented Eddie Gilbert with the trophy in 1984 when the Fabulous Ones, Eddie Gilbert and Tommy Rich, they won that award, that prestigious award from the WFIA. You got to go on live TV with Lance Russell and present this to Eddie Gilbert. And I think we all know what happens next. You know, Tommy comes out, he beats the crap out of Eddie Gilbert. Eddie's sitting there bleeding and crying and saying he's sorry and he just wants to be friends with Tommy Rich again. And Tommy trusts him. Bad move. Eddie jumps him and the Tommy Rich blood bomb goes off. I mean, the studio outside the ring was like crimson. Do you ever get sick of being like that guy that's like your wrestling accomplishment? You can be honest here.
Well, no, because I'm world famous through my photography and art and magazine and podcast endeavors. So that's just a footnote, but I have done a couple of things since 1984, so I feel secure with my reputation.
All right.
I'm primarily a photographer. I don't know if you guys realize if you want to visit me, we're debuting the real website soon, Hardway Art, all kinds of cool stuff, books, photos on canvas, artwork on canvas. But if you want to see a sneak preview, go to Hardway Art on Facebook. And while I'm plugging, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I am Howard M, as in Magnificent Baum. Howard M. Baum on the Twitter, Hardway Art on the Facebook.
All right. And I keep forgetting
to
plug myself.
I mean, no, I mean, it's a beautiful thing being a footnote in that Memphis angle because I was so blessed to be able to participate in that at such a young age, and it just kind of put me on the map as far as being part of a classic angle. Not that I had anything to do with it. You could have had a cardboard stand-up out there, but it's still the experiences that went around it, and it just it happened to be one of the most famous angles, one of the greatest angles of all time. It just happened to be the time that they threw me out there, so I have nothing to do with it, but
You know
it
what? This is
going to
sound crazy. You played your role well.
Well, you know, I didn't know what was going on. I literally didn't know what was going on. I don't know what aspect of this you would like to know about, but they kept me completely in the dark.
Oh, man.
Huh? Right, right. And I was asking Pete Lederberg, like, what's going on? And he was friends with Eddie Gilbert, and they cooked up this angle between them. And I had no idea what was going on. And when you go out there, I don't know how many people have seen the Memphis studio, but when you're there, it's a relatively small studio. They have these giant lights, like, mm-hmm. I don't know, 10, 15 feet away from you. And there's Lance Russell, and there I am, like a young Jerry Lewis out there on TV, like barely 18 years old. And I didn't know what was going on. I didn't even think my jaw was going to work. I didn't even think I was capable of speech at that point.
That's insane. That I had no idea. But then again, now that I'm thinking about it, it's the Memphis promotion. They're not going to smarten anybody up, especially in 1984. I was going to say that was a really good thing that we both got to do. Like, I got to go to the Memphis studio once in 1988. And I feel very lucky. And, you know, now that's all gone.
Stop rubbing it in. Just stop rubbing it in, okay? I see that place in my dreams.
I was actually there a year earlier in 83 as part of the WFIA convention. And I think that was when Jimmy Hart and Andy Kaufman had a big feud going on.
Okay.
And they did an angle right in the studio. They had a little pull-apart brawl. So, yeah.
Wait a minute. You got to see Andy Kaufman in the Memphis Wrestling Studio.
Yeah, that was something. I don't know why I didn't bring my camera, because it didn't even occur to me. But, yeah, they did a full angle. If you look up the 83 Jimmy Hart, Andy Kaufman angle, it was the thing where they were teaming up against Jerry Lawler, like in a handicap match.
Yeah.
And they kept throwing each other into Lawler, like hiding behind each other. So Jimmy Hart's like, he's fixing to break my neck, and he threw me back in there, man.
I have seen that. I didn't realize you were present for it, though. That's excellent.
Yeah, that was something. I didn't even know Andy Kaufman was going to be there. That was quite a thing.
No,
Howard,
I mean,
you're like the Zelig of professional wrestling.
Kinda. I've been there.
That's amazing.
I've done some things.
That's cool, then.
Because I, as John was saying to start off, I had not known – I know the bit, but I had not added one and one and come up with two yet. I knew you as the fine photographer that you are. That part I had known first. So, yeah, but then he's like, oh, yeah, he was in the Tommy Rich and Eddie Gilbert angle. I was like, oh, yeah. So one thing about that angle, if you look at that angle, the whole thing from them as a tag team all the way down to that angle, everything on paper looks beautiful except one thing. They insisted on calling them the New Fabulous Ones.
Well, you know, Scott Bowden and I took a deep dive in that very subject a couple of times. I'm also, by the way, the new co-host of the KFR, Kentucky Fried Wrestling, on the fine Arcadian Vanguard Network, and you guys might want to check it out. I highly recommend anything from episode 37 on, especially.
Did you guys do an episode about 1981 on Memphis recently on that show?
Yeah. We're taking a very deep dive into 1981 right now. We're like in the summer gang wars of 1981, which is a really good – we're not strictly going chronological, but we're taking a good visit at the summer of 1981 right now.
Phenomenal. As good a stretch of wrestling as you will see.
Yeah, I think from then on, you can't think of a weak period for Memphis wrestling. Look at 82 and 83 and 84,
but
85,
was,
and then 86. 86
that was, the
was
hook
over,
for,
but
that was that hook for me when they started the whole. I never knew what to call it, but that's a good phrase for it. Was the gang wars when basically the whole babyface roster who really didn't get along to begin with were like, okay, we don't like you guys, but we really hate him.
Right. That dynamic always worked in Memphis because it would be like they would hate Jimmy Hart, but if somebody else would come in, they would get behind Jimmy Hart for the outside manager, like Jimmy Hart against J.J. Dillon, or whenever some usurper would come in, they would all of a sudden be on Jimmy's side because he was their guy.
This I always thought about, and this is a good example of this, because right at this time, Lawler had come back from the leg injury, and they were doing the bit where Jimmy was bringing in all the guys. This is the where Funk and, you know, all the top guys,
Hogan,
in the business,
Briscoe,
take them out. Yep, they brought in everybody. But the thing that was over by the end wasn't those matches. It was the gang war.
Yeah.
Mm.
it's like Memphis doesn't let – they like their guys. They really never sold much for, like, bringing in outside attractions that much.
Well, I think Terry Funk has been extremely over everywhere he's gone, and I don't know why that particular period of time didn't work for him. I think the No DQ match had a good crowd, but then whatever was in the wake of the empty arena match didn't do that well. So I don't know. I don't know why that didn't work. I thought it was tremendous. I thought it was a highlight in Memphis wrestling history.
Absolutely.
But the Gang War, but they rebooted, and the Gang War thing really took off because you had so many factions going against each other. Tojo with Fuchi and Onita. You had Jim Kent's guys. You had Jimmy Hart's guys. You had the Faces, Lawler and Mantell and Dundee and Dream Machine. So
you had the very young, the very good young babyface tag team of Eddie Gilbert and Ricky Morton right around here, wasn't it?
Right. That's right around the time they made their bones. They had the career-defining, career-making, as Scott Bowden says. They entered boys and they left men after the concession stand brawl with Fuchi and Onita. And I venture to say that might have been, you know, I don't really know which is the most famous concession stand brawl, but for pure action, the Morton Gilbert Fuchi Onita one with Tojo attacking the arena manager's wife in the concession stand might have been the best of them all, although they were all spectacular.
I thought that one was the best of them all, and we were just talking about Memphis not smartening anyone up. She wasn't smartened up to it.
You're right. Tojo smartened her up with a couple of chops to the face.
the world 40 years ago. I miss it.
Oh, anyway, my God.
We're going to continue taking the questions that we did not get to last week. We probably won't get to all of them, but, you know, we've got some pretty interesting stuff here. Sean, what would you like to kick off with?
We're going back to Memphis, which is just fine with me.
Okay.
What are your thoughts of the exotic one, Adrian Street in Memphis, Howard?
At the time, that was a really groundbreaking gimmick, and it was audacious. It was shocking. Today, it's nothing. Yeah. But back then, he would, like, kiss guys to discombobulate them and come out there and say, you know, all this gay innuendo and stuff. He was doing what Goldust did, like, what, 10, 15 years later? Adrian Street was doing that back in the mean old days, not the sanitized WWF. And, you know, he was a nice guy back in the day, too. He and Miss Linda would always pose for me and stuff when they were in Miami. But at the time, it was really a groundbreaking gimmick and very brave.
I'm going to say something about Adrian Street that not everyone's going to like. And it's nothing personal against the guy. I hear, like you have stated, he's a really cool guy. I thought the gimmick – I mean, my observation is that the gimmick kind of bombed everywhere it went. I mean, they tried it all over the place, Florida, Southwest, Mid-Atlantic, and it just never seemed to get over the way – at least that's the way I saw it. Plus, I mean, Street – from what I hear, is just about the toughest guy out there. You know, he didn't look the part, but supposedly he'd wrap you up in a knot before you knew what happened. I didn't think he was a good worker. I thought he was, for a guy that size, I thought he needed to be better.
I could see that because he worked a little of that European style. So his matches had a little something different to them as far as the execution of maneuvers and such, cravats and little – he would do those English kind of things where he'd put the elbow in the guy's face and punch his hand and the elbow would go into the guy's face. Stuff like that, little European differences that those guys did. He had a little run on top against Dusty, and mainly he was in the mid-cards here or the lower mid-cards. After the blow off with Dusty, and he was working the likes of Brad Armstrong and Scott McGee, people like that, in like the third, fourth match. He got good heat just based on the fact that it was the 80s and he was doing a gay gimmick and it was flamboyant, and it was a good heat getter, but I don't see it as a main event thing. You can't take anyone like that seriously. You know, they're not going to win the world title or anything. But he held belts down here, and he was definitely over. It's not like he was like – he didn't have go-away heat or anything. They were certainly invested in – they bought him as a heel down here. And I know he was over in Memphis. I mean, they've got to be more archaic than Florida at that point. So
yeah.
I know he certainly got over there.
They were going to bring him in 1984 into Georgia, and just sitting there watching the thought of Adrian Street in the same stable as the Road Warriors, that would have been interesting to see.
Yeah, you know, I never thought of him in that perspective of him in a major league. Like, I can't see him in Georgia. You know, like, yeah. If anything in Georgia, it would be like one of those guest spots when the guys would come in just to get the TV exposure. Like, they weren't working the territory, but they'd come in and do a match, and that's what made TBS cool. But no, I could not see that, because I don't see that really translating. It's more of a small promotion gimmick, I would have to say, now that you said that.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Sean, what are your thoughts on Adrian Street back in the day?
I have a couple, but one more quick question for Howard on this. Did he get any Street get any pushback? I know Goldust did. From the guys, I mean. I don't mean from the crowd. I mean from the talent.
Well, that I wouldn't know, but he seemed popular with everybody. Like, whenever I was backstage for the brief amount that I was, everyone seemed to, like, you know, say hey to each other and whatever. There was no problem. He was just very cool. I knew Kevin Sullivan back then, and everybody just, you know, all the heels were, you know. I would have to say a big no to that. I think he was respected as a worker, as a shooter, as a talent, and I think that's how everyone treated him. I know Mick Foley is a big fan of his.
Probably has a lot to do with it. And was he a snake pit guy?
A what?
A snake pit guy?
Yes.
That I don't know.
He was? That's what I've heard over the years.
That's what I thought too. So yeah, he's real legit. That's Billy Robinson's group. He was trained too. So I just they seemed confused a little bit. I mean, I know he was over, but it was like it wasn't as over as it should have been. He's very good. And funny thing is, the place I thought he was most over was Southeastern.
You're probably right. And they actually did something really cool where he won the Southeast title and painted it pink, which I always got a kick out of.
Huh. I didn't know that. See, that's a good gimmick. I mean, I could, you know, it works in the smaller southern territories because you're going to have the homophobia, you're going to have the faggot chants. And he was kind of like a spice in the stew. He fit into any of those promotions perfectly fine. You can't build around him as the main heel or anything, but he was fine. Everywhere I saw him, he seemed to get over and get a reaction, and his matches were decent. I can't, you know, I can't say he's Buzz Sawyer, but he definitely was a decent worker.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I mean, you have Adrian Street out there. It's almost like the gimmick was too outlandish for the middle of the card, and that's kind of maybe why it didn't work as well when, you know, in the bigger promotions. I don't know.
But well, he kind of like got the main event spot, but then he was downgraded after that. Like, I think he worked with Lawler, and then he worked lower, and he worked with Dusty, and then he worked lower.
Yeah.
So I think it's that kind of thing. Like, when he debuted, it would be the shock, like, oh my God, who's this guy? And it was definitely as interesting as anyone else debuting, Kamala or whoever it may be. Like, you haven't seen him before. You have to remember, in these days, you never saw these guys before. So whoever it was going to be exciting and different.
I miss that. That regional system where guys would come on TV that you read about in the magazines that you never saw before.
Yeah.
Now we've seen everyone else.
That's awful.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, by the way, half the guys that you would read about in magazines when they finally debuted, they sucked. How I looked forward. I remember it was 1981 and they were having like a special tag tournament or a U.S. title tournament, and they had this big poster made, this big placard, and it was all these names that never came down before. And that's when Baron Von Raschke was going to come down, and they brought in Mil Mascaris. I'm like, oh my God, all these guys are going to come. And they all sucked. See, wrestling back then was all smoke and mirrors. Like, you know, I mean, it's like they promised all this stuff and it never happened. Like, I thought Mil Mascaris could literally fly from reading the magazines. And then when you see him live, all he does is prance around, does a couple of diving headbutts or whatever you call that move, and then the big splash.
That was my exact
experience. And I'm like, oh my God, I thought this guy was like literally going to fly from the rafters or something. after seeing, like, you know, the high flyer, the international star. And it was just an act. I mean, it was just like a set routine that he did.
Yeah. I mean, I was massively disappointed the first time I saw Mil Máscaras, but that was probably less Máscaras and more Bill Apter. I mean, Bill just did a great job getting him over, and that's, you know, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
it, you know, when the match started, I was like, you know, it was a thud. What can I say?
Yeah, yeah. He was really he was lucky as far as his – I mean, he had a great look. He had a great repertoire for photography because everything he did looked great, because what he did was either he was wrapping people up into unusual positions, like all these Mexican shoot holds, which looked great, or he was flying around somewhere. So he was a photographic bonanza between the outfits and his physique and everything else. So definitely, I think that's a huge part. And and by the way, doing a flying body press off the top rope was a tremendous high spot back then.
Back in the 70s, yeah, when Máscaras came up here to go around the horn against superstar Billy Graham, I mean, yeah, that was a wow maneuver, but it was like the only one he had, you know?
Right, right.
All right.
Yeah, sure. And you didn't never realize how small he was until you saw him in person.
Good point. I mean, by WWF standards, you know, yeah, he was muscular, but he wasn't particularly big.
One more question about Mil for either. Was it Mil Máscaras got stretched out of the Mid-South Coliseum in 70? What was it, 78?
That I'm not privy to. If Bowden didn't know, I certainly don't know. That's his obsession, and if he hasn't answered that by now, I certainly can't put anything new on it.
But I'm pretty sure Scott.
My feeling is that it was probably him. Although, how could there be no pictures? There's pictures of like everything, and there's no photos of that night from anybody.
Good point.
That doesn't even seem to make sense.
Yeah.
A quick background for those who aren't familiar: that Mil Máscaras got in 1978, a stretcher job in Mid-South Coliseum, and Jim Cornette has been insistent that it is somebody other than Aaron, but Jerry Jarrett, on the other hand, is insistent that it was. So that has been the debate.
Wow, I'm almost interested. Almost.
Who is the greatest mid-carder in Memphis history, Howard?
Okay, well, I saw this question on your page and I thought, what would I say to that? Because I tried not to prepare too much. I wanted to do it off the cuff. And I thought to myself, now during the time I was there, you see, okay, let me answer the question this way. At one point or another, everybody was a mid-carder in Memphis.
True.
So I'm going to limit to who was a mid-carder when I was there live. And I will say Dream Machine. Because when I was there, it was Dream Machine and Porkchop Cash, teaming as the Bruise Brothers.
Yeah.
And I guess they were semi-main event, but kind of middle of the card when I was there, 83, 84. And Dream Machine was great. And there's so many guys. I mean, at one point or another, Eddie Gilbert, the Rock and Roll Express, Steve Kern, Stanley, they were all mid-card guys. Although Kern kind of debuted in the main event when he came in. He jumped right into a feud because I think Dundee was injured and he just got the spot in the 8-man tag. And
that was the gang war.
Main event spot, right?
That's how
he got
involved.
Right,
that's how
right.
He got involved in the gang war. Yep.
Right. Right.
First guy I thought of was, because I was trying to eliminate guys who had been in the main event. The first guy I thought of was Tony Falk.
A little late for me. Cause I kind of don't count anything 86 and after, like when I think of Memphis, I think up till 85 because, A, I was there live, 83 through 85. And I always hear him get good review. The whole vibe was different after 86 as far as I'm concerned.
No,
I agree,
right,
you know,
but
so I can't, oh, yeah. I can't really put those guys in the same category as, you know.
I agree, but I'm thinking of Tony in 1981 and 82. I remember him from back then.
Oh, I didn't even – oh, I saw him. Snap. I saw him before he did his gimmick. Yeah, I saw him work the Jaguar, which was Danny Davis.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I take it back again. That was Ken Timms. So I can't. I think he was teaming with Ken Timms or something at that point. But I didn't see enough of him at that point. I really couldn't say one way or the other on him.
Who would you say, John?
Pat Tanaka. both as a babyface in like 86, early 87, as a heel single, and then in the tag team with Paul Diamond. I mean, he really never got close to a main event unless it was like a 10-man tag or something. But I thought at that time, Pat Tanaka was one of the best in-ring performers out there. Maybe not the best, but definitely in the top 50 in the United States. He was really good, and I thought he played his role well.
I can't agree or disagree. I've never seen him do anything great, but I haven't seen a lot of his stuff. I knew his dad, Duke Kiyomoka, and his brother, yeah, Chris, because they ran the box office and they ran the town in Miami when it was up to Duke to give me the heads up to go ringside to shoot photos. So I knew Duke. I talked to him every week. And a matter of fact, Pat debuted down here as a referee, like in the early 80s.
I was just about to ask you that. Like I knew he
was a referee. Yeah, I had no interaction with him, and none whatsoever. But
wasn't Duke a random question? Wasn't Duke Hiro Matsuda's partner?
Yeah, like they all had points in Florida.
That's a rough
team. Duke, Matsuda, Briscoes, Jarrett had a small percentage. Maybe the Fullers, Eddie Graham, and I think it Buddy Colt. I think at different times, At different times, people might have sold their shares to other people, and some people might have had more or less. But there was a lot. They used it as like a bargaining chip back then, because like they wanted to keep Jack Briscoe in Florida, so they gave him a part of the office, and then they wanted to work with the Fullers, so they gave him a part of the office. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
they kept their enemies close so they wouldn't jump. They made any potential enemies part of the team so that they had them.
Makes a lot of sense.
So yeah, Duke and Matsuda were definitely owners, and Duke's town was Miami, so he ran the show down in Miami. Pretty taciturn guy. I wish he was a little more loquacious, and I wish I would have had some better questions, because back then we didn't have wrestling historians, and if I would have known the history that he was exposed to, I would have asked him a lot more. Like, we talked about – he was always kind of down in the dumps about the business. I talked to him mainly around 83, 84, and no matter how good the house looked, he was always concerned. He's like, I'm like, well, you're bringing Abdullah in next week. That should pop a house. He's like, yeah, I hope so.
No, you're right.
I never saw him smile or anything, and he was just very dour. And not a very charming family from what I saw of Duke or his son Chris. Because before I actually got ringside, I bugged them for a good year, and they wouldn't let me in. Granted, I was a 15-year-old kid, but I was already published. I was already in the wrestling news, and I said, "Look, but they were like, "No." They were just like, "You're a kid, forget it." But then through various machinations, I finally got in there.
Excellent. You mentioned something like back then, history was a really hard thing to get a hold of. And yeah, I mean, we've got so much at our fingertips now that I would have killed for 40 years ago. So
Right. But the cycle had to play out, because you had to be kept in the dark. You had to be in a mark. And then everyone goes on their individual journey of getting smartened up. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But then in the 90s, everybody got smartened up all at one time, and that's when everything changed. And I think it's kind of like technology and the computers and the internet and the phone. I think it's good to be of a certain age that you lived life without it and you lived life with it, because now you can experience both sides of the coin. Because that we wouldn't trade our childhoods for anything, or have desired a cell phone when we were 18 or anything like that, or to go on Bumble or anything to get laid. We did it the old-fashioned way. We showed up. We put the work in, I mean, now what is this? Like, oh, swipe me and do this. Oh, come on. But it's the same with wrestling. It's like, oh, my God, what's going on? Wrestling operated under a veil of mystery for so long. Then all of a sudden you had the world at your fingertips. Like, I can find out anything.
Yep.
So I think it's great to have both. I think it's sad to be so young that you have only experienced only a life with cell phones and computers, only a life where you have sports entertainment. and you never were there when a real riot was going to break out or anything like that, a real smoky arena experience. Or the same is true of a rock concert, you know?
No,
you go to a Van Halen concert today versus 1984, and it's like people are throwing up in the aisles and smoking and doing acid and having sex. And like today, it's like no smoking and like, you know, big giant screens and everything. Everything's all slick and technical. But back then, everything was a lot grittier.
It really was. And I miss those days. I mean, you know,
totally.
Concert with some chick I just met. Now, maybe that goes on today, but whatever.
You know what? Like, in its own way, I'm sure it does, but no way it was as cool as the stuff we did. And I feel gypped because I was too young to really experience the 70s. I kind of came of age, started going out to clubs and everything in the 80s. That was like my period. I got laid to the soundtrack of Whitesnake and Bon Jovi and LA Guns and stuff like that. But I mean, I'm really a child of the 70s because I was like 10 years old in 76. And I grew up with the sounds of Led Zeppelin around me and jean cut off jeans and dirty sayings on T-shirts and all this stuff. So I'm if I had my druthers, I'd rather have come of age in the 70s. But the 80s would have been my second choice.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, man.
And then after that, I mean, you can have it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we talk about not sticking to wrestling. I mean, I go out and I don't see kids playing football or baseball or whatever. Like, that's all we used to do. We get a hockey game going, whatever. Kids don't do that nowadays. It's crazy.
It's really, really odd. I was never an athlete or a sportsman, but I was outside every night, you know, doing stuff, whatever, throwing rocks around or whatever we did. It's a whole different world, riding bikes, whatever. I don't know. I mean, I see like 5-year-old kids with nicer phones than mine. I don't know. I think in 20 years, everyone's just going to be like a withered body sitting there on the couch with a giant brain just like pecking away at their computers.
Yeah, you know, it'll probably be even worse than that because, you know, technology, technology is weird, but like everything I was warned about with technology or regarding technology in the 80s has kind of happened. But anyway, Sean, were there more questions?
Oh, yes. You know what? I'm going to go with this one. I'm going to add this question. I'm going to add something onto it because it's something that we were talking about a couple of minutes ago.
All right.
If Memphis was doing bad business for the most part in the latter part of the 80s and into the 90s and the other cities were doing well, why not put Louisville as the top city instead in the territories instead of Memphis?
It kind of was.
Off the top of my head.
I mean, we got the show every Saturday, right?
I am not the expert when it comes to that, but just based on my impressions of what I can remember at the time, Louisville did get a bunch of shows. I think they ran the same shows basically at the Mid-South, and then they would repeat it in Lexington. And I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the last actual Savage Lawler match was Louisville. Could be wrong, but I know they had a really famous packed match there, which might have been one of the last sold out or good crowds there. I want to go on record and say I'm not the Memphis historian that Scott Bowden is, so don't hold me to these things, but just my remembrances of the time. There was a lot of good stuff in Louisville. I remember they would actually show some tapes from there. Like they would usually show the tapes from Mid-South, but they kind of switched over to Louisville at a certain point in time to show their brawls and their main events and stuff. So in a way, it kind of did shift according to where they were drawing their crowds. But as a point of pride, it's also known as Memphis wrestling, just like WWF is known as New York. You know, like you call it, it's Memphis. So you gotta represent your hometown. It's Lawler's hometown, first of all. So he wants to stay strong there. He's not going to give up on Memphis.
Another thing, too, I remember that they would sometimes do this. They would fly a guy in on Saturday morning so he'd be at the TV studio. I forget where they typically ran Saturday, but I think they ran Louisville every Sunday night. And then the guy would, you know, so the guy they flew in would work Louisville sometimes. And then Monday he would work Memphis Mid-South Coliseum and then he'd fly home. So that might be part of it.
Yeah, I didn't really – I didn't realize Louisville was Sunday night. But, yeah, that would totally make sense.
Louisville's Tuesday.
I don't really know their – you see, that's what I originally would have said. That's what I originally thought. There you go.
I just looked it up. Okay. I was double-checking. Yeah, Louisville's Tuesday.
See, that's what I – yeah. So, and I don't know what other – I know Jackson, Tennessee was a major town for them. I don't know if they went every week or not. But I know I went there. It was a regular town when I went there every week. So –
Louisville was a very important town for no other reason than it was a Christine Jarrett town.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
So, yeah, they were going to take care of
it. And by the way, have you guys read my friend Brennan Martin's book, All About Teeny, Christine Jarrett?
I have not read that yet.
No.
Really good, really informative, really interesting, good inside stories. And as I told Steve Kern, don't show your wife this book. He was clutching it at the CAC. And I go, Steve, I'm going to do you a solid. Do not show your wife that book, because the best, most salacious story in the entire book is him and Steve and their shenanigans. So
I've heard quite a bit about Steve.
I said word to the wife. And, you know, Steve, his thing was always like, I was married. I didn't do anything in those days. And I'm not here to say anything different.
Nor am I, except that's the one I heard. I heard the ones were pretty.
I'm not going to say anything different, but that's not what I heard.
All right.
No, I love me some Steve Kern. I love me some Steve Kern, so I'm not going to ruin his life. Let's just hope his wife is not an avid listener.
I was going to say, I'm not sure she's, you know, listens every week to Stick to Wrestling, so we can only hope.
Right. Well, I heard she listens to like every other episode. So hopefully this is her off week, Mrs. Kern.
Hopefully she's a big Scott fan. So this made me think of another question, which is that because you had said 1986, Howard, and John agreed too. And I also agree that that was really their last kind of great, great year. I mean, they had some stuff in 87, but it wasn't the same. What was
right,
the difference?
Right. Just the talent and probably WWF's deleterious effects on draining their talent. And the same thing happened to Florida. Look at Florida, 86, 87. It's, you know, before Florida got bought out by Crockett and brought in some talent, which I don't think really jived with Florida. It wasn't Florida Wrestling anymore when they did their merge and their merger and brought in the NWA guys. It just killed Florida. All the Florida guys who were pretty much – not main event guys anyway, they were relegated to the opening of the cards, and it was all the NWA guys coming in who were the main events. So now that was really the final nail in the coffin, because they're like, okay, it's bad enough that we have Cuban Assassin and Ricky Santana in a semi-main event, and now you're bringing Flair and the Road Warriors in and putting those guys who were semi-main event last week, now they're jerking the curtain where they rightfully belong. And that was really it for Florida, because now you just took the talent and subjugated them to the entire NWA roster.
No, I remember early 87, we actually got Florida on cable, and this is before Crockett got involved, and that promotion looked like every week looked like it could have been the last week of television.
Oh, my God. They had this guy, the Black Assassin, just some big, fat black guy with a hood on.
Bill Tabb,
they were, like, throwing everything. I mean – they were just like – it was Memphis at that point. They were just bringing in little guys and fat guys, just – but without the charm of Memphis, because this is the difference, guys, that, you know, a lot of people might poo-poo Memphis. You might not be familiar with Memphis. You might just buy into the bullshit that it's a small man territory and it's a brawling territory and they're goofy and it's a circus. But I'm here to tell you guys that there was a certain charm and color to that territory that no territory – has had. And I'm a Florida guy, but I'll take Lance over Gordon, and I love me some Gordon Soley, definite idol of mine, but I'll take Lance over Soley if I'm going to be listening to wrestling around the house, if I'm burning a tape for somebody or something. If it's Florida, I'll like leave the house or whatever, but or Mid-Atlantic or WWF or whatever, I'll check it out because I'm a wrestling fan. But if it's Memphis, I'm like, oh my God, my friend Lance is in the house, you know. And then the guys the guys, and I don't mean just because I know him personally. I mean, that's just how you feel. That's how everybody feels when Lance comes on. It's hey, it's like an uncle visiting you. Yeah. So Memphis had a charm, and you could take an untalented guy, and as long as you didn't push him for too long and too hard, it would get over in Memphis. Because I think the Memphis people were conditioned to it, like, oh, this guy might suck, or he has a goofy gimmick or something, but he'll be gone soon, so let's just enjoy it. Or next week he'll come back under a different hood and he'll be somebody else. It's a different thing there. They were more forgiving of things that would have killed another territory, but it was part of their package. It was part of the charm.
Yeah, Memphis, I mean, just because of the way the promotion paid, they had to get more out of less, and they did an excellent mm-hmm. job doing it.
And they did, and it wasn't like, okay, Florida's idea of getting more out of less is the dying days of Florida. Hiro Matsuda was really the booker for all intents and purposes. And you had a couple of guys that were left over that had been in Florida for 5 or 6 years, Kevin Sullivan, Blackjack Mulligan, Bugsy.
Ron Bass.
Mike Graham. Yeah, and I mean, those guys were down here forever. And mm-hmm. you usually don't see heels homestead like that for so long, but you had those guys, and then filling out the card, the undercards and the mid-cards were pathetic from 85, 86 on. They had some decent periods. They had the Fabs and the Sheepherders. But, you know, you had my friend Tyree Pride working Ric Flair in the main event at the Miami Beach Convention Center, where Terry Funk beat Jack Briscoe. Come on. And no, I'm friends with Tyree Pride, but come on.
I mean, I remember.
So what I'm saying is, I mean, Florida looks like shit getting by on that kind of talent. And Memphis, like, that's par for the course. Like, okay.
No, I'm with you.
And that's not a knock on Memphis. That's just saying that the way they use them, they actually use them in an entertaining way. If somebody sucks in Memphis, they come out on TV and they make a joke out of him. And people laugh at him and then he's gone. But in Florida, they try to push him. Like Dewey Forte was supposed to be the next Ron Simmons, and like he didn't get over. He didn't have any ability or charisma, but they used him because he was a football player and he was like Ron Simmons light. Ed Gantner.
I remember.
You know, these
Dewey
guys were
Forte,
terrible.
I mean, he talk about a lack of physical charisma. My God.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're right.
It was sad.
It totally dried up at the end. And you're right. Yeah. It was sad. But what are you going to do? That was post WWF expansion, and you know a lot of promotions went down quickly, and Florida was one of them. I mean, I remember like early 85. I mean, that talent roster was pretty thin.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I left for college.
Yeah.
Oh, back to Memphis for a second in this time frame, because what you were just saying is where I was trying to go with it. About Memphis having a certain charm, and you know it's very distinctive. And I agree with you with Lance. Gordon's the best announcer ever, non-Lance category. Okay, Lance has his own area,
non-Lance category, really, exactly. Yeah,
you really don't get Lance unless you hear like 6 or 8 or a bunch of episodes in a row, and you just kind of mm-hmm. binge watch.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he becomes like your friend. He's like Uncle Lance. So,
yeah.
But some of that charm I felt started to leave after 1986. And I was wondering because for example, 1984, I always thought – I didn't like 1984 as much as some people did because I always thought that Jerry Jarrett worked better with less. Like if you gave him too much stuff, it's almost – you didn't know what to do. You know, it's just like this – you know, all this talent all over the place. He doesn't know. You know? But when you give him a nice short bench of like 10 guys – you know, really, you know, solid guys, and he'll do wonders like he did in 1981.
Yeah. And they were all, for the most part, like local. The Memphis crew in 81 were like, that was a quintessential Memphis lineup, you know, all Southern guys, many of them getting their first break as far as being in big programs and getting over and getting pushed and all that. And Memphis had to be one of those places where more people broke in than anywhere else.
Oh, I'd say definitely. And you know what? Even if you were a heel that may not have been that great, you had Jimmy Hart. And when they put you next to Jimmy Hart,
yeah,
I mean, you got elevated. It was really simple.
Yeah, so. Because if you came out there with Jimmy Hart and you didn't get over, brother, you suck. You know, if you're standing there with Jimmy Hart and it didn't work, you're gone.
Kick Donovan says hi. one of two people I've seen him not be able to get over. He was amazing. His crew at that time in 1981 was Kevin Sullivan, the Nightmares, and Wayne Ferris.
Kick Donovan, Larry Latham.
Yep.
Or no, not Larry Latham, the other guy, Honky Tonk Man.
Wayne Ferris.
Yeah,
Kevin
yeah.
Sullivan, and then Chick came in later, but he wasn't there long because even Jimmy couldn't get him over. Jimmy was a miracle worker.
No, I know. You know, I'm going to save a little bit of this because I want to talk about it on the next KFR, but Chris, Chick Donovan, and another guy who's really nice to me, always posed for me in Florida and everything. I always thought that I don't even know how to phrase this, but he just managed to take victory from the jaws of defeat. He's whatever the saying is. I don't know. All of a sudden, I'm losing my mind. But I always rooted for Chick Donovan, but he could never. Come on, Howard, put it together.
He could never turn the corner.
Yeah, like he couldn't put it all together in a way that was going to work for him. And I think
he was missing it.
He was missing that.
Like there was an old line, I think it was from the late sports writer Paul Zimmerman, said about an old Patriot linebacker. John will remember him. Nobody else will. Monty Beisel. And his description of Monty during one game was that Monty would drop back, get in the perfect position, have his number two pencil sharpened, and then nothing would happen.
Right.
And that was Chick Donovan. It looked good, kind of.
I mean, Donovan, he had a good look, but he could not do an interview to save his life, and he wasn't a particularly good worker. So right there, he was not a lot of fire either.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like he – it's a very interesting case because for all intents and purposes, he was a career jobber, but he almost looked like somebody that should be a main eventer, but he was – just as you said, he was lacking in the charisma, the personality, the talking, and the working. But for some reason, you expected more out of him. And what's funny is, I know this will get a good pop when I talk about it on KFR from Scott, but because I was watching this very period so I could bone up on it. And I thought, okay, he's trying something new for an interview. He's not going to say that again. But he came out there and he goes, to end the interview. And catchphrases were not de rigueur back then. Like, not everybody had a catchphrase. But Chick Donovan, 2 weeks in a row, came out there and he said, and baby, I can get sassy or I can get nasty, but I'll get it done. And he was a heel. He was a heel. And he's trying to do this, like, Bob Armstrong kind of Southern jive interview. Like, I can get sassy or I can get nasty.
And it's worse than it sounds. It's worse than it sounds.
Yeah, pretty much.
Chick Donovan mid 87, kind of spring 87, when he was teaming with Stretcher Jack Hart, managed by Paulie Dangerly. That was a fun tag team.
Yeah, I didn't see any of that.
All right.
Somewhere Chick Donovan's going, gee, what podcast do I want to check out today? I want to see something new.
Oh, my God. No, the poor guy, but I mean, see, here's what I think hurt him. It's a couple of things. Number one, the stigma of being a jobber. Every time anybody saw Chick Donovan, he was doing jobs either in Florida or he got a minor push in L.A. during the 70s, which I'm sure no one knows about. But it was like, I mean, he got a little bit of a push he was pushed as an actual worker. In Florida, he was kind of a jobber. In Georgia, he was totally a jobber. So he has the stigma of being a jobber. Even though he had a good look and everything, but he couldn't really back it up. And he was too Southern, and not the good kind of Southern, you know, not the kind of Southern that would translate, not the Jimmy Valiant kind of Southern. It was more of like a, you know, I could see him being a semi-main event in Alabama, in the Southeastern Territory or something, if they would have used him as smart as they could have. I don't know what you could have done to get him over.
You know, I want to ask another thing. I remember him in World Class in 1984, and they did an angle where Butch Reed injured his knee. I just remember Donovan coming across. This is, once again, this is him being a bad interview. As just a big crybaby about it. I mean, he's a bad actor.
I like the interview in Memphis when he was down on himself and he was going to quit, and Jimmy Hart came out to convince him to join the First Family. I thought that was actually pretty decent because this is an angle that you would only see in Memphis. He comes out there and he goes, "Yeah, Steve Kern beat me, and you know what? I'm just disgusted. I'm going to quit. I suck." And like, it was realistic because he did, and everyone, it was kind of sympathetic. What he should have done was turn babyface right then and there. You know, have Lawler come out and take him under his wing or something. But Jimmy Hart got him, and then, of course, he couldn't get over as a heel, and that was it.
I wonder who told him that sassy was the right way to go. I'm picturing Lawler, you know. Oh, no, it's a Memphis thing. Oh, no, they love sassy. Yeah, just go with that. It'll work, I promise.
I picture Lawler in the back, like, smirking at his interview, like, oh, man. You know, I don't see Lawler being a fan of that sassy, I can get nasty thing. But in 1985, there was a independent promotion in Florida called the IWA. And they had some money behind them, and they ran Tampa, they ran some big towns, they had some decent shows.
Was this the Rusty Brooks promotion?
No.
Okay.
This is way bigger than a Rusty Brooks production. Rusty Brooks used to run, like, handball courts in Dania. But, and he was being used as like a semi-main event guy. And a matter of fact, he had really great matches with Chris Champion, who is like the semi-main or main heel in that group. And they had TV and everything. And they had some really good matches, but I attribute a lot of that to Chris Champion because he was on fire back then in 1985.
Okay, yeah. So this is right before he joined Florida, because he actually told me the story of he would go to the CWF matches. And as usual, if you're a wrestler, you always have your gear. And he would always ask, can I come in and work? And one day someone didn't show up and he got his shot. He said, you know, he put on his most colorful outfit and went out there. According to him, he got over.
I believe it, because that guy was amazing back then. As far as somebody that you never heard of in 1985, he was really great. He was really spectacular. And I'm not like I don't push a lot of people, but he was great. He was one of my favorite guys because I used to shoot photos for that group and everything. I'd go up there, and he really impressed me every time I saw him. And he was a good interview too.
Yeah.
At his valet, Anastasia. And he was a great interview, and he was a good guy back then. He, like, you know, he fell apart. He self-destructed, apparently. But 85, 86, he was a great worker. And he got picked up by Florida right after he worked for that group. But thing is, he was working Chick Donovan in that group. And they had really good matches, which I attribute to Chris Champion mainly, because I've never seen Chick do anything that great before or after. But in my head, I'm thinking, oh, this group's not going to make it. If they're trying to use Chick Donovan as a main babyface, and he wasn't the main guy. Like, on top for that group was Bugsy, I want to say.
Oh, man.
They even brought in Mr. Wrestling, too, which is, it was 1985, but he was still past it in 85.
Yes.
Mr. Wrestling, too. And he didn't do a lot of TV for them anyway, but I want to say their main baby faces were Bugsy, probably, which is acceptable, maybe a little bit past his prime, but acceptable for a Florida top baby face. Like, who else are you going to get?
Yeah.
And they had a decent roster, but I'm thinking, oh, man, if Chick Donovan is as good as they can do for a semi-main baby face, they're in trouble. Sorry, this turned into like the burial of Chick Donovan. He's one of the guys that was so nice to me when I was
We got to be honest on the show.
Yeah, I know.
And that's the thing, you know, when you are on national cable every week losing a match, you get typecast. It's just the way it goes.
Right. Let me just say this. That not only does he have the stigma of a jobber, but it's like, how bad does this guy suck if he looks so good and he always loses? Like, this guy must really suck. But also, think about it. He was doing a fourth-rate Ric Flair gimmick, and you're comparing yourself. Now you're putting yourself in the Ric Flair category or Superstar Graham category or Hulk Hogan category. You're blonde, you're muscular, but you don't bring anything else. And now people are going to be like, oh, he's like, you know, he's like a fourth-rate star.
No, he definitely had the look. I agree with you there, and but unfortunately, that's kind of where it ends. Yeah, Sean, do we have time for one more question?
One more, and this seems a good way to finish it off. In your professional capacities, Howard, what's your favorite match you've seen live?
Fabulous Ones versus Sheepherders, Memphis, Mid-South Coliseum, 1985.
Wow.
It's what I call combat photography, because the thing is, when I'm shooting a good – my photography is as good as the match. And if it's a slow match, I'm like, Logie, they're out of focus. They're not whatever, but it's like they're not what's the word? Come on, I'm a photographer. Composed, the composure and everything. You're just not on it. You're like sleepwalking. You're like, whatever. But when Flair comes out, Flair and Wyndham, all of a sudden I'm the greatest photographer in the world. And in Memphis, I love nothing more. My favorite kind of wrestling is a big Memphis brawl, an all-over-the-building, table-breaking brawl. And that's exactly what that match was. And I call it combat photography because I would purposely put myself in peril. If I knew Steve Kern was going to throw Rip Morgan into the turnbuckle, into the post outside the ring, I would be between them and the post to get the shot. And it had to be focused, it had to be composed, and I had to have some adrenaline going through me or I was fucked. And I got it. It just made me alert. And that was easily the greatest match I've ever seen live or anywhere.
Nice. Not expected, but that's kind of more what I'd want. Like an answer that makes me say, wow. Sean, what was your favorite match that you saw live?
Now, with this said, I have seen two WWF cards live. One, I think the main event was Hogan and JYD against Terry and Dory Funk back in
Atlanta. That was from Boston.
And then the other was that Stoughton High School extravaganza in 85 that had a main event of Moondog Spot and ST Jones. So for WWF, that's my best match so far. So now I have to go to ECW. And unfortunately, there's not a lot to pick from there either. So I'm going to go with in the match in the – I can't remember the town. I'm saying Milton. It wasn't Milton. I'll remember it later. But it was a small town in Massachusetts, and it was Sandman against Ray. And they battled into the comptroller's office.
Okay, yeah, you talked about that.
And I heard some little woman screaming, take it outside. So that is probably my favorite live experience.
The best match I've ever seen live, and yeah, wow, I got to end on this. The best match I've ever seen live was the Ric Flair versus Ricky Steamboat match in the New Jersey Meadowlands in Memorial Day weekend 1984. Wow, that was more than 35 years ago. The one that I know does not exist on tape anywhere. There was a match in the Boston Garden between Bob Backlund and Ivan Koloff in 83 that went about 40 minutes. And at the end, Backlund got the pin and the crowd stood up and cheered, not the result, but the match itself, which is something that you never saw in Boston.
Never.
This was, major.
I mean, you didn't see that in wrestling back then. I've never seen it in my life.
Come to think of it, neither have I. At least not until like the very late 80s sometimes you saw that. But anyway, Howard, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show.
I had one last question, John.
Oh, sure.
What about the Bob Orton and Backlund match? I almost had that written down.
That one, another one that I wish I could go back and see. The difference between the two, I remember them being like 4.5-star matches. The Orton match didn't get that crowd result, so that's kind of the tiebreaker.
Okay. No, I just figured that was going to be your answer, so I was just curious as to why.
All right, cool.
And by the way, I think you guys will get a kick out of this. We're having a lot of work done in the apartment, and so people are coming in and out. And I have a property manager, and I have a bug guy, whatever you call it, a bug guy. I can't think of the word.
Bug guy.
It's good you got me early before my brain started turning to mush. But no, so on separate occasions, I had conversations with these guys because they were in my apartment, and I have some memorabilia laying around. And they're like, bro, you know, are you a wrestler or something? I'm like, no, I'm just kind of like I've been around the business my whole life, whatever. I go, right now I'm on a couple of podcasts, whatnot. I'm a photographer, and I have some stuff laying around. It's obvious, whatever. So he's like, you know who I love, man? I'm like, who? Because I'm always curious. He's like, Bob Backlund. So then a few days later, that's the property manager. Then the bug guy comes over, and he goes, you know who I like, man? Bob Backlund. I'm like, what
Where
are
these
odds?
Guys from?
they got to be from up north. I mean, obviously, but and you know, I don't like this revisionist history where people shit on Bob Backlund because he was great. I saw him live in the 70s in Florida. I saw him live as champion, and I saw him on the MSG network and all that when he was on top against everybody. And Backlund was great. I don't want to hear anybody dissing Bob Backlund. I know you guys are fans, if I'm not mistaken. But
I am a fan now. I was not a fan back in the day. Like, I would always go to the guard.
Not his personality, but I appreciated his work because look at him against Greg Valentine or Don Morocco. Like, who else was going to have those matches against those guys?
No, when Backlund was on, he was absolutely great.
Yeah, and he was such a true athlete. Like, people say Steve Kern might have become WWF champion instead of Backlund. It was just who Eddie Graham decided to send up there because they wanted the All-American boy. I see Backlund heads and shoulders above Steve Kern. Now, mind you, I love Steve Kern way more as a personality and everything else. Backlund always had an odd personality. But in those days, I think it legitimized him because he was clunky, he was awkward, he sold weird, he made odd noises, but everything he did looked good and real, and it looked like amateur wrestling, and he was in the best shape of anybody.
No, and the thing, when we've talked about this about Backlund before, his interviews, you have to go back to a time and place. It could have been, he did an interview the way like Tom Seaver or Cal Ripken Jr. would do an interview. And it came off legit. But anyway, we're out of time. Howard, thank you very much for coming on. It was a great show, man.
It is an honor, guys. I appreciate it.
I'm glad I finally got around to it. Sean, thank you for everything you do. This podcast has been a presentation of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, and I want to thank our producer, Lou Kippelman. We'll see you all next week. Everyone, have a happy and safe 4th, even though you'll be hearing this afterwards. Why did I say that? Have a good week, all.
Whoop, whoop.